Okay, let's get rolling again. For anybody for whom this model wasn't complicated enough, let me add one other thing, which isn't in the diagram because it's sort of perpendicular to everything else. You know, we've talked about the impact of cognitive distortions, and that plays an important role here, too. If you look back at these underlying assumptions in the diagram, you know, the world is a dangerous place. Okay, wait a minute, what's dysfunctional about that? You know, is anybody here who would argue about that the world is not a dangerous place? If so, we can hear that, too. If you can look at it moderately, the world has no shortage of dangers and risks. That's adaptive, not dysfunctional. But borderlines tend to go in for one particular cognitive distortion, dichotomous thinking, seeing things in terms of two mutually exclusive black and white categories. They either see the world as totally benign, the Garden of Eden, or terribly dangerous. And they vacillate between the two. And if I treat the world as though it's totally safe, this ends up being dysfunctional. If I treat the world as though it's terribly dangerous, this also ends up being dysfunctional. And if I can't see the shades in between, you know, each of these are issues, Erickson would argue, these are all issues that we all deal with in the course of growing up and hopefully come to an adaptive resolution to. But if I'm stuck seeing things in black and white categories, that makes it really challenging to come up with adaptive resolutions. The idea that I'm weak and vulnerable. If we can look at that moderately, I'm not Superman. I've got limitations. I've got shortcomings. I've got flaws. So I should use good judgment what challenges to take on. I should, you know, have people who can help me out when I need help, etc. No problem with that. But if I look at it dichotomously, then either I'm hopelessly flawed and vulnerable, or I'm Superman. And borderline clients will bounce back and forth between those two. They spend more time, you know, feeling terribly weak and vulnerable than they do feeling omnipotent, but they'll do some of each. You know, I'm flawed and unacceptable. If I can look at that moderately, I've got flaws and shortcomings. Not everybody's going to be a big fan of mine. Not everybody's going to accept me as I am. No problem with that. That puts me in the same boat with everybody else. And I've got choices about how to deal with it. But if I look at it dichotomously, either I'm so wonderful everybody's going to love me, or so horrible nobody can love me, which is the dilemma the borderline is dealing with. So, A, the dichotomous thinking makes it really challenging to come up with adaptive resolutions in these areas and perpetuates the problem. It also pushes us to intense reactions one way or the other. You know, if I try something and succeed at it, hey, I'm a success, this feels wonderful. If I try something and fail at it, oh my God, I'm a failure, this feels terrible. And you bounce back and forth between the two. You know, whereas if you can look, if I succeed at something, this doesn't mean I'm a success. It means I succeeded at this one thing. That's good, but I'm not going to be dancing on the rooftops. If I try something and fail at it, this does not mean I'm a failure. It means I failed at this one thing. That's a bummer, but it's not going to have me massively depressed. So that's another impact. And the dichotomous thinking has an important impact on relationships. If I go to party and meet somebody new who is attractive, seems to like me, seems to be a cool person, you know, if I can look at it moderately, hey, this looks promising, I should get to know this person better, you know, maybe I should see if I can get their phone number, you know, but if I'm looking at it dichotomously, either this person is wonderful or they're terrible. They're obviously not terrible, so they must be wonderful. This must be the person I've been looking for. This is the person who's going to make my life complete, you know. And this feels wonderful, which encourages that line of thinking. You know, I'm going to be, you know, pursue them vigorously. I'm going to be dedicated. I'm going to be thinking about them 24/7. I'm going to feel wonderful. Until they say or do something that doesn't fit with my idealized image of them. If it's something small, I might be able to gloss over it and keep seeing them as wonderful. But if there's something I can't gloss over, if they don't call me when they're supposed to, you know, if they're talking to my rival, you know, then I no longer can see them as wonderful. Well, if they're not wonderful, they must be terrible. And I thought they were, they're terrible, but I thought they were wonderful. They must have been deceiving me. You know, so I go nuclear. They're blown away. They did not see this coming. They have no idea what's going on. Either they run away screaming, in which case the relationship has gone down in flames and I end up blaming myself. Or they apologize, they make nice, they cater to me, they patch things together, and we're off on a roller coaster relationship. And so the dichotomous thinking has a big impact in a number of important areas and really amplifies the other issues we've been talking about. So what the heck are we going to do to be helpful to these people? Well, the good news is CBT actually can be very, very helpful. And we've even got a handy-dandy game plan on page 4 in the handouts. You know, like working with everybody, we're going to want to start off developing a good collaborative relationship because we need a solid foundation for the work we're going to be doing. And, you know, some of this is challenging for the client. And then clients with borderline personality disorder tend to enter therapy at times of crisis. So the odds are good early on we're going to be, you know, doing a lot of crisis management and putting out wildfires and trying to get things stable enough so that we can do ongoing work week to week. Once we get things stabilized enough so that we can actually work on stuff, increasing self-efficacy turns out to be a real useful intervention, you know, sort of across the board, but it ends up being real useful with borderline personality disorder. And one of Marsha Linehan's valuable contributions, Marsha has come up with dialectical behavior therapy, which I'll be talking about more in a little while. She started off researching suicide, and in doing that, she identified a group of chronically suicidal individuals she was doing research on. And not surprisingly, they turned out to, by and large, have borderline personality disorder. So she ended up researching borderline personality disorder, even though that wasn't what she started off doing. And one of her contributions is registering that with borderline personality disorder, you get a bunch of therapy interfering behavior, is her label for it. This is not what the client intends to have, the effect the client intends to have, but some of the client's behaviors happen to have that effect. You know, if I react real intensely to little things that the therapist does, then this creates a lot of chaos in the therapy session. The therapist is busy trying to figure out what the hell is going on and figure out how to deal with it. And that makes it a whole lot harder to do effective therapy. And if we can do something about it so there's less chaos in the office, then that greatly improves the odds of doing therapy effectively. The client tends to come in with a different problem each week. And that makes it a whole lot harder to intervene effectively. If we can do something about that and maintain a consistent focus, that improves our odds of being effective. And, you know, Marsha's contribution is noticing this and registering that early on in therapy, we want to deal with the therapy interfering behaviors that are getting in our way so that we can then accomplish useful stuff. And we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. One thing I found to be challenging is a new client. It's, today's topic is very critical. You know, this is what's going on. Next week is totally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then this is what's making it difficult. It's a new client, so mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about that in just a couple of minutes. Once we get things calmed down enough so that we can just work week after week the way we typically do in therapy, a big part of the problem is the intensity of the client's emotional reactions to stuff. And so if we can help them tone down the intensity, react more moderately, and also deal with emotions more adaptively, that both does them a lot of good, and it also makes it a lot easier to work on the other stuff we want to work on. There are often major interpersonal problems in helping the person switch to more adaptive interpersonal behavior is typically a good next step. And if we've gotten to the point where the person's reacting somewhat moderately and their relationships are not too screwy, then we've got a shot at addressing the beliefs and assumptions that perpetuate all this. At which point, they're probably going to be doing a whole lot better, and we finish up by working on relapse prevention. And termination tends to be a little tricky, because we're dealing with somebody who anticipates rejection and abandonment, and if we're not careful, ending therapy can feel like rejection and abandonment.
Yeah. Are people with BPD pretty attuned to their over-the-top emotional reactions?
It varies. It's certainly is not at all hard to help them register that the intensity of their reaction is part of the problem. Often they come in seeing it as completely justified. They blame it on the other party, the other person's being totally unreasonable. At the same time, they see their intense reactions as part of what makes them unacceptable and gets them rejected and abandoned and fired and so on. And another interesting side effect of the dichotomous thinking is you get a lot of totally contradictory points of view floating around in the person's head at the same time, and they just never run into each other. You know, and they don't get around to registering. Wait, if it's all their fault and all my fault, that doesn't really fit together. Who really is here to blame? And also, as long as we've got the dichotomous thinking going, it's hard for them to conceive of anything other than it's either all their fault or all my fault. So that makes it sound like we might want to get to the dichotomous thinking pretty early on in therapy.
So they really do have a problem standing in the cloudy or gray areas of things.
And a piece of it is, think of how you are when you're really upset. This is probably not prime time for thinking clearly, not prime time for looking at things moderately, not prime time for effective problem solving. And the borderline client is doing a lot of intense reactions and not a whole lot of moderate reactions, which really complicates their life for them. And one of the big advantages we have as a therapist is I'm not as upset as they are. Even at the times when I'm upset, I'm not as upset as they are. So I've got a better shot at thinking clearly, looking at things realistically, and then with a little guided discovery, maybe I can help them get to that point, too. Now, there are a number of practical problems, sort of management issues, in working with borderline personality disorder. Okay, we're starting off developing a collaborative relationship. We do that with everybody. And part of what that takes is talking over goals for therapy and agreeing on what goals we're working on. And this is complicated in several different ways with the borderline client. You know, for all the borderline clients who don't feel okay about speaking up for what they want, if I say, oh, great, one of the things I like to do at the beginning of therapy is figure out what we want to accomplish. Imagine we work together for a while and we're wonderfully successful. How would you like things to be different when we're done? I'm asking them to speak up for themselves, and they're afraid that if they speak up for themselves, they'll get rejected or abandoned. This puts them in a complicated situation. With some borderline clients, this is mild enough so that they're uncomfortable, but they can go ahead and say, well, I'd like to be less depressed, and I'd like to be less anxious, and I'd like not to lose my temper so much, and I want to stop cutting, etc. And for some people, it's mild enough so we can go ahead and discuss goals for therapy in the usual way. Now, for those people, we generally end up with a long list of goals. And the challenge is, okay, how do I get my head around this and figure out how to proceed? Like for Mary in the book, we have her goal list there, which is like 14 different goals. And, you know, goal 1A is I want all my anxiety symptoms gone before we work on any issues, but I don't want to take any meds. Okay, how do you do that? You know, and so A is going to take some discussing and negotiating and prioritizing. One thing I find useful is to organize the goals into different clumps. So if you look at Mary's goal list, there's a bunch of different anxiety-related goals. Okay, let's have an anxiety clump and a relationship clump. And, you know, and that makes it a lot easier to get my head around. And it's often useful to the client, too. You know, and we need to both pay attention to what their priorities are, but we also need to think through both conceptually, does it make sense and make a difference what we get to first, and practically, does it make a difference? You know, when a person's got a whole bunch of hairy, complex problems, And also, they're not yet comfortable being open with me. They're afraid of rejection and abandonment and so on. If we start off on some of the here, you know, if a person has a history of childhood sexual abuse, and we start off with that, that gets into tricky territory real quickly, and it's going to be really hard, you know. If we can start off with something more straightforward and superficial, if a person has a history of childhood sexual abuse and a problem with freeway driving, there's a lot of advantages to starting with the problem with freeway driving. Okay, this is not the important one, but we can work on it in straightforward, simple ways that don't take too much self-disclosure. I know what to do about that. You know, figuring out what to do about their history may well be more complex and take more thought. And we've got a good shot at making noticeable progress within a few weeks, which does a lot for motivation to persist in therapy. If we start off with a hairy, complicated issue that's going to take a while to make any noticeable progress on, particularly if it's one where they may feel worse before they feel better, it's really easy for people to get discouraged and give up. So all things being equal, I'm going to vote for starting on, you know, with some of the more straightforward stuff and build up to the complex stuff, and that gives time to work out some of the interpersonal complexities of working together. Now, I may need to do some negotiating, and there might be important reasons we need to start with the hairy stuff. For all the clients who have a hard time speaking up for what they want, then I'm going to need to take a more active role in discussing goals for therapy. They may come up with a couple socially acceptable, you know, I want higher self-esteem, I want to become a better person, because they think that's what people are supposed to say in therapy. They think that's safe. They think that's not going to get, not because they read that those are really their goals. So what do I do? I'll say, okay, and I'll write that down and repeat it back to them. And I say, gee, you know, in the initial vow, you mentioned being really depressed, but you haven't mentioned that. Would you also like to, you know, be less depressed? Hey, you mentioned panic attacks. Would you like to understand what's going with that and learn how to deal with panic attacks and how to have them not stop you from doing what you want to do all? But then, oh, you mentioned losing jobs because you get mad at coworkers. Are you interested in learning ways to deal with anger that don't get you into so much trouble at work? And I'm going to need to take an active part for all the people who aren't okay with speaking up for what they want. If I make it, you know, a multiple choice test, if I say, hey, are you interested in this? They're a lot more comfortable saying, yes, sure, if I propose it, than proposing it themselves. And that makes it a lot easier to then work together to figure out what to get to first. Now, once we know what we're, you know, trying to accomplish, you know, often the next problem we run into is we had all that the nice discussion last week. This week they're having panic attacks. The next week they're angry, etc. And if we get into crisis of the week mode, it's really tough to make any headway because none of these are so small that I can resolve them in a week. And we've got several different options there. Once this pattern becomes evident, or if from their history and previous therapies it's obvious up front that this is going to be a problem, I can say, gee, last week you were really upset about X. This week you're really upset about Y. You know, sounds like these things are really, I want to be empathic and supportive and so on. The problem is, if we're focused on a different issue each week, that makes it really hard to make any lasting headway. You know, if we could come up with a way to focus, pick a problem and focus on it week after week, then that greatly improves the odds of, you know, accomplishing what you want to accomplish. That makes sense to people. You know, and we got a range of possibilities. For people on the mild end of the range, they may well say, hey, that makes a lot of sense. I can deal with my mother-in-law. Let's stay focused on my panic attacks. Great. Then we focus on their panic attacks until we've made substantial headway, and then we get to their mother-in-law or their depression, or whatever's next on the list. You know. Now, I've got a nice middle-class suburban population. I get the milder end of borderline personality disorder, though how mild that is varies a lot. You know, and maybe 20% of my borderlines can sign on to that. So this is what I try first, and it sometimes works. What's more common is, you're right, Doc, that makes a lot of sense. I'd love to be able to do that, but I'm so upset with my mother-in-law. And so, round two is, how about if we spend part of the time on your mother-in-law or whatever you're upset about in a given week, and part of the time maintaining a consistent focus? You know, what's your top priority? Okay, we're going to work on your freeway driving some each session, but we'll also save some time for anything that's really important to you that week. How's that sound to you? And a high proportion of my caseload can sign on to that. If we're doing that, which do I want to get to first? If I start with the crisis of the week, it's really hard to rein people in and switch to something they're not upset about. And so in my great wisdom, I can say to the client, you know, if we start off working on something you're really upset about, then it's not easy to shift gears partway through. And, you know, so how about if we start off with the freeway driving and we can both watch the time and we make the point of, you know, shifting and having plenty of time for, you know, your argument with your mother-in-law. That, for maybe another 60% of my caseload, that is doable and works well. It takes some activity on my part. I need to get comfortable with saying, okay, but we need to get back to focusing on driving. Now, there also are plenty of perfectly fine people where what they're upset about this week is so emotionally pressing that they can't set it aside. In which case, we need to focus on what they're upset about this week. And as I do that, I can watch for underlying issues that cut across the different problems. And by addressing those, we can make consistent headway even though we're on a different topic each week. For example, if I haven't gotten to dichotomous thinking yet, is the fight with their mother-in-law involves some dichotomous thinking? Does freeway driving involve some dichotomous thinking, etc.? And I may well be able to work on dichotomous thinking, whatever issue is coming up. Or with Mary, you know, and there are many different anxiety problems. She got anxious in elevators. Okay, that's fairly common. She got anxious on airplanes. That's real common. She got anxious on escalators. That's not as common. She got anxious on the freeway if she was in the left lane, not the right lane. That's a little strange. She got anxious at parties, but only if somebody else drove, not if she drove. You know, what really set things off was her husband proposed a vacation in the Caribbean, and she started having panic attacks. That's not the usual response to a vacation in the Caribbean. You know, at first it seems like a random assortment of anxiety problems. And on that level, we could work on coping with anxiety in each of these contexts. But it turns out these are all situations where she feels trapped. You know, airplanes and elevators are obvious. I can't get out. Escalators, I can't get off till I get to the top. Freeways in the left lane, I can't just pull off at the next exit. I need to be in the right lane to do that. Parties if somebody else drives, I can't leave when I want to. If I drive, I can leave whenever I want to. She actually never wanted to leave early. She was always one of the last people there helping clean up afterwards. But knowing that she could leave, she didn't feel trapped. Vacation in the Caribbean. It's an island. You can't get off until your flight home. I didn't point out you can't get off the planet because she was already having enough panic attacks. And once we identify, you know, she freaks when she's in a situation where she feels trapped. And then whichever one of these comes up this week, we can look, oh, is this a situation when you where you feel trapped? What makes you feel trapped here? What's serious about being trapped? How can one deal with the feeling of being trapped? Etc. Now, that's more complex and more work on my part. So if we can sign on to working consistently on one issue, either for the whole session or part of the session, I go for that first because that's easier. You know, if we need to focus on a different issue each week, I'm going to think in terms of what ongoing issues can I address in this context. And thinking strategically, if I haven't gotten to dichotomous thinking yet, I'm going to want to, you know, get to that early on in treatment because that makes a big difference in the intensity of emotional reactions and, you know, dealing adaptively with interpersonal situations and resolving deep issues and all sorts of stuff. Another management issue that's real important is limit setting. All the people who write about borderline personality disorder, from all different theoretical perspectives, the object relations people, the schema therapy, everybody agrees, setting clear, consistent limits and following through on them is really important, simply to make therapy manageable. And there's a couple aspects to that. One is, suppose I'm afraid that I'm unacceptable and people are going to reject and abandon me if they get to know me, and I'm in therapy and this therapist is trying to get to know me. This makes this a tricky situation because I'm real likely at times to be afraid that my therapist is going to find out terrible stuff about me and reject or abandon me. And this is a challenging thing for the client to handle, particularly if they don't feel okay about speaking up and asking for what, you know, if the client was okay with saying, "Doc, I'm really afraid you're going to reject or abandon me. Do I need to freak about this?" Then I could say, no, actually, I understand, you know, lots of people have that fear. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. I've known all sorts of people. I really doubt if you can come up with anything about you that's going to result in me rejecting or abandoning you. And that, if we could talk it over directly, that would calm things down substantially. But they're not going to feel okay. It's going to be too scary for them to bring up directly. If I just bring it on them, that's going to freak them out, and they won't even hear the second half of what I say. And so how do people in therapy figure out if they have to be afraid of being abandoned or not? They may well start off being good and obeying all the rules, and things go okay. Does this mean I'm not going to be abandoned, or does this mean I haven't been abandoned because I haven't been bad yet? Down to the borderline, it's going to seem like, I haven't been abandoned because I haven't been bad yet. Oh my God, if I break the rules, then I'll be abandoned. How do I find out if that's the case or not? Well, if I break a few rules and I don't get abandoned, then maybe I can calm down. Or maybe I just wasn't bad enough. So I break a few more rules. And unfortunately, there's no stopping point to that strategy. And it's easy for the person to get escalate farther and farther in terms of testing the limits and demanding special treatment and so on. And we've got a couple different rounds to dealing with it. The more things are vague and unclear and it's not clear what's okay and what's not okay, the more anxiety that's going to generate, the more the person's going to be afraid of inadvertently doing the wrong thing and getting abandoned. So if I can be clear and upfront about what's okay and what's not okay, then we've got a lot less vagueness and ambiguity, and for people on the mild end of things, that may calm things down enough that they never get into testing limits in the first place. For a lot of people, it's going to calm things down some, but not that much. But then if they break a limit and I just calmly, consistently follow through, they discover, I don't get abandoned. The limits do indeed get enforced, and this may well calm things down enough so that they don't need to escalate and get more and more extreme in testing limits. You know, for the people where, you know, they accelerate anyway, then I can, you know, that's just a gee, I noticed this pattern's happening, what's going on here? And it gets it on the table so we can talk it through. Yeah.
Can you give me an example of, you said, setting a boundary, what's not acceptable?
Yeah, and it's going to vary from setting to setting. You know, in our setting, you pay your copay at time of visit. And that's upfront, that applies to everybody. You know, and there's no shortage of borderline clients who show up without their checkbook, who, you know, ask for special arrangements, etc. And setting clear, consistent limits is one of these things that sounds simple on paper. In real life, it's not necessarily so simple. For those of you who've had two-year-olds, how easy is it to be clear and consistent about limit setting? That's another population where clear, consistent limits really pay off. And it's a lot more complex to do in real life than it is to do in the abstract. One thing that's important is it doesn't work to have one set of limits for this client and a different set of limits for that client. Because then when somebody calls at 2 in the morning, I say, okay, who is this? What's going on with them? Is it okay for them to call me at 2 in the morning or not? It doesn't work. it doesn't work to have one set of limits for borderlines and another set of limits for people who aren't borderlines, because then at 2 in the morning, what's this person's diagnosis? It still doesn't work. And also, one of the things that happens when you follow through on a limit is a lot of borderline clients take it personally, and their initial reaction is to feel rejected and abandoned, and they're off and running. And if I've got different limits for them than I do for other clients, then I'm in a real tough position in trying to get across the idea that this is not rejection or abandonment or cruelness or meanness. So what I need is a consistent set of policies across the board that apply to everybody for all the things that come up routinely. You know, when does a person pay their copay? What if they can't afford therapy this week? You know, what do you do if you have a crisis between sessions? What do you do if you want to come in at a time when I'm not normally in the office, etc.? And it's not that there's a right answer to these. You know, I've worked places where you pay your copay at time of service. I've worked places where you submit it to the insurance company, then you get it back from the insurance company, and then you bill the person for the copay. That results in a lot more people going to collections. But I need to have policies for all the ordinary stuff that I feel okay about following through on, that are clear in my own head, and where this is not a personal reaction to the client. This is how we handle copays. And I also need to think through, how do I want to handle it for somebody for whom, if a person really can't afford to pay their copays, then they can't afford to see me. I need to help them find somebody they can. Maybe a place with a sliding scale would be a good match for them. You know. And I happen to be a nice guy. My natural tendency is to be flexible and make adjustments. And this turns out to be a bad idea. You know, it's a much better idea to be clear, upfront, and consistent. And this is a lot easier on the client. There are a number of issues that get resolved a lot more quickly that way. And it's part of what it takes for it to be viable to do therapy. You know, because if I, you know, make accommodations and I'm not collecting copays and I'm scheduling appointments at weird times and I'm doing long conversations in the middle of the night, I'm a mellow, tolerant, laid-back guy, but I'm eventually going to get fed up with it, and this is going to get in the way of being an effective therapist. You know, I need to arrange things so that it's practical, so it meets the client's needs, so it meets not my needs. This sometimes takes a little thought.
So I had this client, and in the agency where I work, they have to sign a paper, like they have to cancel. If there is any cancellation, it has to be done 24 hours. Yeah. Otherwise, they will pay. They have to pay $25.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the only one who was really upset to sign that paper, and no one ever. You know, from my experience, said anything about that everybody was agreeing. Mm-hmm. That's what you said, like being having a fit about something little.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when I talking to, and that end up, I just had a feeling that that was the reason that she quit after two sessions or so. And so she ended up saying that she was before diagnosed by bipolar, and that she was diagnosed also as BPD. My question to you is, can those two be, you know?
Sure.
Both.
You know, diagnoses are not one to a customer. You know, and off the top of my head, I can't think of any diagnosis that makes it impossible for the client to have some other diagnosis.
So they can go, those two, they can go together. You know how some diagnoses you cannot have them both.
Well, some diagnoses preempt another one.
Right.
So how do I want to handle that kind of situation? You know, it would be real useful to find out, what is it about signing this form that's upsetting to her?
Mm-hmm.
And it may be there's a simple misunderstanding that can clear up.
When I asked her, she said that she feels that's how poor people are treated, like that, just to threaten them, just to make them as if they are not taken seriously, you know, stuff like that. So I did.
I want to address each of these. And if this is a policy across the board, you know, actually, this is not specific to poor people. This is a policy we have with everybody. You know, This is not to threaten people. You know, it's not to enrich myself. It's basically, I can't be helpful to people if they don't show up.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I try to do is set things up so as to encourage people to actually show up for their appointments so I can be helpful. You know, another part of it is, if I want to be available to you, you know, if somebody else takes an appointment time and doesn't show up for it, then I can't offer you that time. So, you know, what we encourage people to do is schedule appointments that they want and intend to show up for. And in reality, stuff changes sometimes. So, you know, you need to let us know if things change and you don't want an appointment time. And it would be great if we could just ask nicely and people would follow through on that. But the reality is, people follow through better if there are consequences. This is the best we've been able to come up with to handle it. And if somebody's not willing to live with that policy, they've got the right to go elsewhere and find somebody who's got a different policy. Now, with a lot of borderline clients, one of the things that'll come out would be, if you cared, you wouldn't have this policy. In which case, if that gets it on the table and, you know, puts me in a good position to talk through, is this a matter of me not caring? Well, no, actually, I've tried to set up my practice so as to be able to help the people who come to see me. And the reason we've set it up the way we set it up is this is our best idea about how to set things up so that therapy works out well and ends up being helpful to people. You know, if I didn't care, you know, I would do things differently. But that's hypothetical. You know, this is my best attempt at setting therapy up so as to head off problems, so as to set the stage to be helpful, you know. And, you know, this is the way it is, take it or leave it, but it's not a matter of caring. And generally that works quite well. You know, particularly as it sinks in that this is not something personal, this is the policy across the board. Good concrete example. You know, borderline clients are notorious for calling therapists in crisis in the middle of the night at home. Barb and I, our phone number is in the phone book. Any borderline client who wants to call us up in the middle of the night can. Don't tell your clients that. We don't get prowls at home in the middle of the night. How come? Well, A, you know, with everybody, we say, if you have a crisis between sessions, this is how to reach us. You call the office number, you hit zero, the answering service pages us. This is for emergencies, this is not for changing appointments, etc. And, first of all, being upfront about what to do if you have a crisis, for people on the mild end, they say, oh, okay, that's what to do if I have a crisis, and that calms things down. Now, for the people who, you know, need to test the limits to find out if we're going to abandon them or not, you know, okay, they may well call in the middle of the night. You know, if it happens, you know, the first time it happens, A, you know, I want to set things up so I'm not reinforcing non-desired behaviors. If somebody's lonely and wants to be comforted, you know, if somebody's bored, if somebody, whatever, and would like to talk to somebody warm and supportive, is calling with a crisis in the middle of the night going to work? No. If you call with a crisis in the middle of the night, you get crisis intervention. You know, and I'm empathic and supportive, but I don't spend a lot of time being warm and cuddly because that just encourages more calls in the middle of the night. You know, but also, you know, if either from history I can tell this is going to be an issue or if it starts to be an issue, I'll talk through it. Okay, you know, so one thing that's been coming up is, you know, crises in the middle of the night. You know, any thoughts as to how we could handle things so that this works better? And I'll flip the end. What happens to a lot of people is they don't want to be a pain in the butt, they don't want to annoy me, etc. So without really thinking about it, they figure, I don't want to call unless I really need to. I'll wait as long as possible. And on the surface, that seems like a good concept, but in reality, what that means is they wait as long as possible. They're getting more and more upset. This is tough on them. Eventually, they get so upset they can't hold off anymore, and they're calling me at a time when they're really upset. This may well hit in the middle of the night. I may or may not be available instantly. This doesn't work out real well. suppose I don't want to be a pain in the butt, and I also don't want to be any more miserable than necessary, and a problem is developing. Things are starting to take a turn for the worse. Is it a good idea for me to wait as long as possible, or would it be a good idea for me to call before things get too bad? In fact, if I catch it early on, I could call when it's not yet urgent and leave a message, and the therapist calls me back in a few hours. You know, if I don't catch it that early and things are starting to get urgent, if I call and let the therapist know it's urgent, or if it's really urgent, if I page, then I haven't been miserable hour after hour. Things aren't maximum intensity. The therapist is calling me back during business hours. It's quicker and easier to resolve. And helping people register, they're not doing me a favor by holding off as long as possible. They're not doing themselves a favor by holding off as long as possible. It's actually to both our advantages for them to call early on when things are sliding downhill, rather than waiting until there's an emergency. That ends up being really useful. And Barb and I have had a lot fewer calls in the middle of the night once this occurred to us. Now also, early on, we're going to start helping the person, you know, identify what they can do when things start sliding downhill to turn things around. Borderlines have a reputation for being manipulative. My take on it is, some of the times, you know, actually borderline's intent isn't manipulative at all. It ends up feeling that way to the therapist because the borderline is having an intense reaction one way on one time and a different way on a different time, and with time lags and so on, things get screwy, and this is not anything at all intentional. But also, one of the things that comes up is a lot of borderline clients are hesitant to be straightforward and direct because they're afraid it'll get them rejected or abandoned, and go about things indirectly. For example, with Jane, I got a call from her one time, really upset about how mean and cold and unreasonable her psychiatrist was. And if I just took things at face value, I might well find myself, gee, he's a real bastard, you should find a different psychiatrist. Fortunately for Jane, I took the time to find out, well, what happened, you know, identify some thoughts and feelings and so on. It turned out that what was going on was actually in her last appointment with her psychiatrist, Jane had lost her temper and yelled at him. And she was afraid that he wasn't going to be willing to see her anymore. And what she really wanted me was for me to call her psychiatrist and find out if she was in big trouble or not. But she wasn't okay with being straightforward and direct, so she was ranting about how terrible he was. And there was no way I would have figured that out without asking her. You know, so A, you know, when more than one treater is involved, good communication is real handy. It's really easy for therapists and psychiatrists and case managers to end up at cross purposes, not because the borderline is trying to do this, but because the borderline sees things one way when they meet and are meeting with their psychiatrist, and a different way when they're meeting with their caseworker, and a different way when they're meeting with their parole officer, and a different way when they're... And things can get real screwy real fast. But also, I need to take the time to understand the situation before reacting to it. You know, if I just shoot from the hip, you know, I may well make things worse rather than better. Now, if Jane's afraid that she's pissed off her psychiatrist and wants me to call and find out if that's the case or not, then I've got a choice about, is this something I'm willing to do or not? And that'll depend on where we are in therapy, what we're working on currently. If we're far enough along that we're working on her handling interpersonal problems more adaptively and being more assertive and communicating more clearly, this would be a wonderful opportunity for her to practice that by calling her psychiatrist herself. If we're not up to the point where it's reasonable to have her handle this herself, yeah, why not? I can call the guy and, you know, express Jane's concerns and find out how things stand. I also knew the psychiatrist was a, you know, reasonably competent, perfectly reasonable guy who's been yelled at by many borderlines and is not going to be abandoning in a hurry. But I wouldn't want to presume that. You know, I don't have an upfront guarantee. I don't know him that well. So giving him a call would be a perfectly reasonable way to handle it.
So would you address that with your BDP patient, that how he or she is going around instead of addressing it directly? Would you address it? Because that would be one.
Now, again, it depends on where we are in therapy and what we're working on. You know, at the point where we're working on my relationship with the client, you know, it would be a great opportunity to illustrate the advantage of them being straightforward and direct with me rather than beating around the bush. And if we're working on, at the point where we're working on dealing more adaptively with relationships outside therapy, it would be a wonderful opportunity to address that issue. You know, it also could happen at a point where there's much more important stuff we're working on. This isn't the time to address it. You know, I might file it away to get to in a few weeks. You know, it depends on, you know, we want to choose our targets and try to maintain a consistent focus, particularly with clients as complex as this. It's real easy for the therapist to get scattered and confused. So I'm going to want to try to keep things, you know, online. I'm going to try to remember what the agenda is, what our priorities are in therapy, what I've got in mind for today, so that I don't get confused and lose track of what I'm doing. Since I've got the clipboard there for writing down thoughts and so on anyway, I find it real handy to jot down, you know, what I've got in mind for today, you know, and then the things that are important for me to keep clear, if I've got them written down, then improves my odds of remembering them. Now, borderline clients have a knack for reacting intensely, not just to stuff in the outside world, but to the therapist too. And so another level of working effectively with borderline personality disorder is dealing with the client's reactions to us. Here we got a quick example. The therapist here is Jackie Persons from the Oakland Center for Cognitive Therapy.
Was fine. I talked to this woman. I asked about her kids, and she, you know, showed me the whole pictures of the whole nine yards. Second day, I asked another woman about her kids, and she wasn't quite as receptive, but, you know, all it went okay.
Mm-hmm.
The third day, I knew this guy had kids. I knew they were off at school, so I, you know, didn't want to talk about his kids. So I asked him, you know, well, how's your wife? And he looked at me and he said, my wife? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we've been separated for the last year and we're going into divorce proceedings. God, I was so humiliated. I was just, there were people around. I could sense that they were, I don't know whether they were snickering or what. I was humiliated, you know. And I thought, God, why did you make me do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's bad enough that I'm dealing with all this stuff at work, and, you know, I come here for help, and you give me this assignment, and
it feels like it's pretty undermining.
So, and a borderline client probably would do that several notches more intensely. How do we want to deal with that? You know, each of us has our own tendencies in terms of responding to anger. For a lot of people, the natural response is to defend myself. And in this case, wait a minute, I didn't tell her to go talk to this guy about his wife. Her homework assignment was to chat with people about their kids. And, you know, when we discussed what problems were likely to arise with this assignment, she didn't bring this stuff up. It's not my damn fault. But if I defend myself, you know, the client's going to feel like their message hasn't gotten through. They're going to get more intense. It's also going to, you know, be more likely to come across as I don't care, etc. And it's going to make it a much bigger deal. You know, Now, that doesn't necessarily mean I want to go to the other extreme and blame myself, particularly if I honestly don't think it's my fault. Now, A, we're dealing with somebody who is hesitant to speak up clearly and directly, who has trouble dealing adaptively with feelings and so on, and they're letting me know they're angry. Hey, this is actually a good and useful thing. And, hey, you know, labeling feelings may well be a skill that they could stand some practice at. And it gives us a good opportunity to talk about handling feelings and maintaining the relationship and working together. And here's the way Jackie ends up dealing with it.
I thought these assignments were supposed to be like to help me get better. Mm-hmm. If anything, I avoided everybody the rest of the week. I just
that was a setback.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you feel pretty angry. Pretty angry at me.
Yeah, I feel angry at you. I was like, well, why am I even coming here?
Well, let's talk about this. Would you be willing to work on it with me? Because I'd like to see if you and I could work well together. And of course, you feel angry at me, and you feel like I'm undermining you. Then that's no good. That's not what you need at all.
No.
Okay. So now, help me. You felt like what? I pushed you into something that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was going to be. I didn't think it was going to be easy, but yeah. I didn't think it would turn out like that, and I just felt very unprepared. I didn't know how to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So
then you felt angry at me for pushing you into the situation that you weren't prepared for, and that turned out badly.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me ask you this. When...
Ta-da. So, you know, we're not talking, you know, anything, you know, fancy or incredible, but having the presence of mind to listen, understand, and collaborate rather than latching into defending myself. Or one of my tendencies is when somebody's bad at me, I tend to back off and be more of a blank screen, which then leaves lots more room for the client's fears and fantasies to run free. Turns out to be a really bad idea. I need to be self-aware enough to stay out front and direct when somebody's mad at me. And each of us needs to know ourselves well enough to know if our sort of automatic reaction to anger is a fine idea with borderline clients, probably not. Or if we need to pay attention and make a point of responding non-defensive, putting our energy into listening, understanding, be empathic and supportive, and then gently helping the person register, wait a minute, she wasn't pushing me into doing this. This was something we talked over together and I chose to go along with. And maybe it would have been a good idea for me to express my concerns about the assignment, you know, last week, etc. Questions, comments, reactions?
Well, I mean, she just, the therapist really went out of her way to sort of pause and say, now wait a second, tell me again exactly what was upsetting about
mm-hmm.
all this. You know, so.
Yeah, and my bet is that part of the pause was, what the heck is going on and how do I deal with it? Completely legit part of our reaction. Because this stuff pops up unexpectedly, you don't see it coming. You know, Jackie, knowing the client, how they would pick up on the anger faster than we did, I could see some of the anger there from the beginning because I've watched this tape many times. I don't know how obvious it was to you. And probably some of you are more vigilant for anger than others, so some would notice it more quickly than others. You know, we each are who we are. And one level of it, dealing with the interpersonal aspects, is we need to be in touch enough with our own reactions, etc., to handle it so it doesn't muck up therapy. It also can give a lot of insight, you know, how do I feel when she comes on in this way? That may give me perspective in how her coworkers experience her and how her spouse experiences her and, you know, how the lady at the grocery store experienced her and may give me some clues as to how she might want to do things differently to have relationships outside of therapy work out better. On page 5 in the handouts, we've got some additional ideas about avoiding manipulation and also about some ideas about dealing with crises. With borderlines, a lot of crisis intervention is the same across the board, but with borderline personality disorder, often the emotion is the crisis. The problem is that the person's so upset. And rather than immediately lapsing into problem solving and so on, you know, if we start off by being empathic, working to understand, you know, reflecting and so on, often that de-escalates things substantially. And it often turns out that actually the person doesn't need help dealing with a problem situation. Once the emotions have calmed down, they can handle it just fine. Sometimes they also need help with problem solving, but that needs to be after they've calmed down, not while they're real upset. Sometimes, you know, clients come in an uproar because they're either afraid of being rejected and abandoned, or they're afraid they're going crazy. And if I simply respond calmly, I listen, I understand, but I treat it as a problem to be dealt with rather than treating it as an emergency, that often de-escalates things substantially. Often part of what's going on is the person's afraid it's an emergency. They don't feel okay about asking, "Doc, is this an emergency?" So instead they sort of act it out and then notice how I react. And if I say, "Oh my God," then this really freaks them out. And I say, "It just sounds like a real problem. We need to put this on the agenda and take it seriously." They see it as a problem to be dealt with, and that de-escalates things substantially. On page 6, we've got some ideas about toning down the intensity of the client's reaction. Hey, it starts off with number 1, you know, responding calmly, but at the same time making it clear that I'm taking it seriously. And has a bunch of other good ideas.
What does the second one mean? Do not reinforce intense expressions of affect.
Yeah. Basically, you know, if the client's upset and this gets special attention from me or accommodations made or special, if there are payoffs to being upset, then that encourages people to put their energy into being upset. And I don't want to reward any behaviors I don't want to encourage. That doesn't mean I should be cold and heartless when the client's upset. It means I need to take them just as seriously, give them just as much of my attention, etc., work just as hard when they're calm as when they're upset. And, you know, if there are areas where I'm willing to make special arrangements, I want to respond to calm, reasonable requests better than tantrums. It's just like dealing with the 2-year-old. If the 2-year-old wants a new teddy bear and throwing a tantrum gets them a new teddy bear, then they're going to learn to throw tantrums when they want something. You know, if they're not getting a new teddy bear no matter what, sticking to my guns and following through on limits helps them learn that throwing tantrums doesn't pay off. If getting a new teddy bear is a viable option, I want to set things up so that asking reasonably for a new teddy bear pays off better than throwing a tantrum. And this is not always easy to think through in the heat of the moment, so it can take a little practice.
So, just a question.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do? Because we know the BPD, they get stuck in the gray. It's hard for them to come to the, either white or black, it's hard for them to come to the
mm-hmm.
middle. And they come like right, what would, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the video. And get emotionally, in that emotional crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So just validate them and listen and not encourage them.
But stop and think, what do I do with dichotomous thinking? Hopefully you remember, the continuum technique is Jim's favorite intervention and works great with dichotomous thinking. I'm probably going to want to watch for a good opportunity to address the dichotomous thinking directly. And we'll get to an example of that on the video in just a moment. But just so I don't overlook important stuff, One important thing in limit setting is how you do it. And on page 6, we've got the SCT approach to communicating with borderlines. I stole this from I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, which was a psychodynamic book about borderline personality disorder. And I don't recommend it in general, but it got some good stuff in it. And this is one. If I just say, you know, the client comes in massively depressed, they're sitting on the couch all day, you know, thinking depressing thoughts, and then what they need to do is get their butt up and be more active. If I just say, dude, you're sitting on the couch all day moping, you need to get up and be more active, they're real likely to experience that as cold and uncaring and rejecting, and we're off and running, now they're terribly upset at me too. You know, if I have the presence of the mind to say, I'm really concerned, you seem to be feeling so much worse this week than last week, you've been spending all your time sitting on the couch thinking depressing thoughts, you need to get your butt in gear, then it doesn't come across as cold and uncaring. You know, so that when I'm going to confront the person with the impact of their behavior, I want to first express empathy, concern, caring. Because if I just confront them, then we're off and running. If I express empathy, concern, caring, and then point out the consequences of their actions, there's a much better chance of them taking in the message and making use of it. I also need to be in tone with my own reactions. On page 7, we've got a graph.
I just have a quick question. Yeah. So that approach, that's from the pretty well-known book.
Mm-hmm.
That's from 1980. Do you still find that book pretty on target?
I don't recommend it to clients because it gets into a bunch of psychodynamic stuff I don't agree with. You know, basically, this is the most useful thing I got out of that book. I think later on we're going to get to some recommended resources for clients and families. So I think we'll get there. Top of page 7. We've got a graph here. This is with 10 months of my working with Jane. This is real life. The top graph is her level of suicidality. The C's are points where she cut herself. The I's are points where she had an impulse to cut herself and didn't. The middle graph is her level of anger at me, which got pretty intense from time to time. And the bottom level is my level of thoughts of retiring. This was like 20 years ago, so they didn't come up nearly as often. And what I notice as I look at it is there's not a whole lot of correspondence between the level of my thoughts of retiring and her level of suicidality. You know, so dealing with suicidal clients is stressful, but I deal with lots of suicidal clients. You know, the interventions work just fine. You know, that was not getting to me. But they correspond real nicely to the first 3 times when her anger at me hit a peak. Okay, this is one of my issues. I really don't like people being angry at me, ask Barb. You know, and so, again, I need to be in touch with myself and manage it so that this does not end up being a problem. One of the options we've got is we could use these handy-dandy CBT techniques ourselves. At the bottom of the page, we've got a thought sheet from a therapist working with a borderline client. He's home Friday night minding his own business when a single female client calls him at home rather than calling to answering service in tears, saying she feels all alone, she's thinking of suicide, her only wish is that someone would show her that he cared, and then she hangs up. And she won't pick up the phone when he calls her back. And he has images of hugging her and telling her that things are going to be okay. And he's experiencing fear at 90%, excitement at 60%, sexual attraction at 60%. He's being honest. Guilt, 40%. Thinking, I have to go to her place right now to see if she's all right. She needs me. If I can't come to her rescue at this time of need, I'll be abandoning her. If she kills herself, it's all my fault. I have to prove that I care.
Who is this?
This is a therapist. And if he stops at that point, we got a single male therapist going over to a single female's apartment late at night with sexual attraction at 60%. This gets well-intended people in deep shit. Fortunately for him, he stopped and thought and put it down on paper and realized, wait a minute, I don't have to go to her place. What I need to do is figure out, is this an emergency, in which case I call the rescue squad. This was in Philly, I think. This is what they call the EMS there. Or if it's not an emergency, I don't need to do emergency stuff. Wait a minute, we've been through this before. It keeps turning out that, yes, she's upset, but it's not an emergency. If she's not going to pick up the phone, that's her own damn business. I'll give her a try tomorrow. And at our next appointment, we need to have another discussion as to whether this is an appropriate way to handle things and what's a better way to handle it. And this has him maintaining his license, and it's so much better for the client, too.
Is this something that this individual did right after this, like in between after the client call?
Yeah. If you want it to be useful, you need to do it before you respond to the situation. Yeah, if you rush over to her apartment in the middle of the night and then the next day you stop and think it through and realize this was a really dumb idea, that doesn't do a whole lot of good. Yeah, so particularly in a situation where you're reacting out of urgency, particularly if you know this is one of those areas where you end up regretting what you end up saying and doing, stopping and thinking it through is a really useful skill to practice. And greatly improves the odds of responding in appropriate ways rather than getting yourself in trouble. It's amazing the number of mental health professionals who end up having sexual and romantic relationships with borderline clients. Hey, all the licensing boards are clear. This is not okay. This puts your license in jeopardy. Don't be an idiot and do this. Even if people didn't have any personal ethics, this is a rule that gets enforced. Also, if for some reason it seemed like a good idea to get romantically involved with a client, is a borderline client who I would want to sign up for? This is not a fun, rewarding relationship. This is a really challenging relationship. One of the things I need to do is have the good sense to take care of myself and, get my emotional needs met aside from my work, so I don't slip into meeting my own needs through my relationships with my clients. And grad school really should give a much stronger dose of that, as you know.
Can I just address one thing?
Mm-hmm.
So this is something we're supposed to encourage our clients to do it, right? That you do it before this kind of something severe situation,
mm-hmm.
you will regret it.
Yeah.
But I noticed that in terms of getting practice, enough practice doing this kind of thought work, they usually have a challenge about doing it, at least if not right away, reasonably as soon as you can. I noticed they have a challenge.
Well, and so when people aren't doing that, we want to take the specific situation one at a time. Mm-hmm. And, what was the situation? What were they feeling? What thoughts were running through their head? To understand why they don't stop and do it then, why they wait till later. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's simple practical stuff. I'm at work. I don't want people to see what I'm writing down.
Mm-hmm.
And we can help them think through, okay, so how can you find some privacy? I had one client where, going to the supply closet to write out a thought sheet worked great. Go to the John, write out the thought sheet if you happen to work somewhere where people can be looking over your shoulder. I've also had a lot of clients where when we stop and think about it, they realize, oh, actually nobody looks over my shoulder, nobody's going to see this. But if we don't talk it through, they don't register, oh, I don't have to worry about this one. And sometimes it turns out to be deeper, more complex issues. But whenever somebody's not following through on what we're trying to get them to do, picking one situation at a time, finding out what the situation was, what were the thoughts and feelings, what did they actually do, often clears up why they're not doing it and gets it on the table so we can address it.
When you are signing for a whole week, you're going to see the client the next
mm-hmm.
week. Do you usually ask them to do once a day or depending on event?
Depends on what we're trying to accomplish. And, if we're trying to understand their depression, then I'm probably going to ask them to do a thought sheet whenever they find themselves suddenly becoming noticeably more depressed. And that might even not happen this week, early in therapy. It generally happens several times over the course of the week. If we're working on their anger, I'm probably going to ask them to do a thought sheet when they find themselves getting angry. If we're working on procrastination, I'm probably going to ask them to do it when they find themselves procrastinating. It's a question of what... And usually, it's not a matter of how many times to do it. Now, for the people who tend to be compulsive, I'll tell them they don't need to write down everything. If they write down two or three, that's probably going to be all we can cover in the course of a session.
you know, feel free to write down more for their own reference, but we're only going to have time to deal with a few of them. Now, if we can deal with all the interpersonal complexities, then we can go ahead and do therapy. And so let's go to the video. This is Joan, or a recreation of my session with Joan, who had been job hunting, husband got an offer in New City, etc.
My employment counsel.
This is our third session. So her homework assignment, our top priority is getting in gear on job hunting. And so one homework assignment was to write a couple job application letters, figuring that if she actually got them done, great, this is a step towards job hunting. But what was more likely would be she would find herself not able to follow through on it, and she can pay attention to the thoughts and feelings, and this will help us figure out what's blocking her from job hunting. And her other assignment was to get up off the couch and be more active. I was lobbying for a mix of chores and pleasurable activities. She really was insisting on focusing on doing chores, so I said, okay, do chores, basically. And so that's where we left off the last time.
And job hunting was a total fiasco. And your ideas didn't seem to help at all. I don't know. Maybe this isn't really the right kind of therapy for me to go into or something. It just doesn't seem to be working.
So you sound pretty discouraged.
Actually, she doesn't sound discouraged. She sounds angry, but this is my defenses kicking in. You know, I'm human. One of the stumbling blocks with borderline clients is that they often come in with some intensity, and it's really easy to just go with that and not get around to setting an agenda, in which case we spend a session on whatever they happen to be upset about at the moment, whether or not they want to do it. So, you know, I want to be empathic and caring, but I also want to get an agenda set. And it generally doesn't take anything fancy. If I say, gee, it sounds like you're really upset about that, we'll spend some time on it. Is there anything else you want to be sure to get to today? Here's what I've got in mind. That gets us to an agenda, and it doesn't sound cold and uncaring. In fact, it sounds like I want to make sure we get to what's important to them.
Nothing went right the whole damn week.
And so it sounds like one thing that would be good for us to spend time on is talking over how the week went and figuring out how everything came to go wrong. Do you have any other things in mind you'd like to be sure to get to?
Well, I don't know. If you really think it's going to help to talk about it, I don't know. The suggestions you made about getting myself to do things around the house.
Now, I interpreted that as her saying, okay, we'll talk about that, and I don't have anything else. You know, based on knowing her, that was the message I got from that. Obviously, that involves a little reading between the lines, but also the session went as though I was right on that one. You know, it certainly wouldn't have hurt for me to clarify, are you saying that, you know, discussing how the week went so badly and what we can do differently is all we need to get to, you know, would have been perfectly fine. That fit with what I had in mind, so I didn't have other agenda items I needed to propose.
They did make me feel better. I mean, they put me in a better mood and everything, but then I just felt like, geez, I should be doing something. I should be, instead of doing the laundry and going grocery shopping, I should be writing job letters or out there trying to find the right company for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that instead of directing my energies against all the day-to-day stuff, that I decided I was going to write 50 letters. I was going to write 50 letters mm-hmm. for job resumes.
How did that feel when you decided to take that on?
Well, first I thought I could really do it, you know, because it's something I've just got to do it, and I can't stand being sitting around anymore. I feel so, I feel so discouraged, as I told you, and
so at first setting that real high goal for yourself. yourself felt really good.
Yeah, it did, because I thought, gee, if I can do that, then surely something will come of it, you know. Yeah. 50 letters, I mean, that's a great odds, you know, for getting...
Has anybody in here ever written 50 job
no.
application letters in a week?
No.
No, not me.
My whole life.
50.
Yeah.
And when you sat down to write the letters?
Well... Sort of funny in a way, because once I sat down to write the letters, then I just felt totally unable to do it. I just thought, you know, that's a lot of work, and so I just thought, well, you know, maybe I really should take care of getting dinner first, you know, and then I'd make dinner and everything, and then after dinner it would be, I would have time, but then I would think, well, now I really want to watch this television program, and I wanted to be with my husband for a little while, and then it just sort of got pushed back and pushed back until it was the next day, and
you can see how, you know, here we focused on some specific times when she found herself not writing the letters, and I didn't have to ask about the thoughts because it happened that she volunteered the thoughts, and, you know, it's, you know, and what, how long did this take? 2-3 minutes? You know, she's basically explaining to me, where I set the goal so high it was overwhelming, and I found myself coming up with excuses not to do it and didn't get any letters written. And, you know, she may well not have processed, oh, that's what happened, but she's made it obvious to me that, yeah, setting your goal that high is counterproductive.
Are you still in the process of setting the agenda?
No, we've gone on to working on the agenda.
Okay.
Yeah, that basically, you know, I proposed talking about how her week went and how everything came to turn out badly and how to get things to go better, and she agreed to that. You know, the way she agreed to it was, well, if you think talking about it will do any good, which, knowing her, I took as agreeing to the agenda.
Oh, that's what she said. Okay.
Yeah.
There were an assortment of different thoughts running through your head. Basically, I should do the dishes first, I should do dinner first, I want to watch TV. A variety of different things to do instead of writing the job letters. Do you remember other thoughts that were also going through your head in that situation?
And one of the things we can do is simply by repeating the thoughts back to the client, A, we find out if we got it right. B, they may well correct us or add on. But see, they not now notice the thoughts. You know, it just sort of highlights, oh, these are the thoughts that were going on in that situation. And one of the reasons clients don't figure this stuff out on their own is they're going through life, all this stuff is going on at the same time, and it's easy for the important stuff to get lost among all the other stuff that's going on. So by simply reflecting the stuff back to the person highlights the stuff that seems important to us.
Well, I remember thinking that my employment counselor, I don't know, I just felt sort of betrayed by him, you know, in a way, because...
I jump in pretty quickly there. You know, I had asked her what other thoughts ran through her head, and she's off to talking about the employment counselor. Watching the video, I think I jumped in a little more quickly than necessary. At the moment, it seemed as though she was changing the topic. And so, you know, how do I want to deal with it? You know, if I say, no, thou shalt not change the topic, this does not maintain collaboration. If I just go with the flow, we're off on some new topic. So what I want to say is, gee, that sounds important too, but if we switch gears to that, we don't finish working on what we're working on now. You know, let's stay on, you know, the job letters and get to the job counselor later. Now, it wouldn't have hurt for me to listen for another minute or two before doing that.
The time. What I'd like to do is sort out the job letter situation and then get to the employment counselor so it doesn't get too complicated. So, was the employment counselor on your mind while you were trying to get around writing the job letters, or was that a different?
Well, yeah, I mean, seeing him as, I mean, he's supposed to be trying to help me get a job. So, yeah, it was on my mind when I was doing it, because,
So you're thinking about a lot of things you'd rather do. You're thinking about an employment account.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I was thinking, you know, why do I need this guy? Why do I need him? Why do I need you? I should be able to do this myself. Mm-hmm. I should be able to get all this done all by myself. You know, I mean, I'm a bright woman. I've got a degree. All of my friends that I graduated with have jobs. So why shouldn't I?
Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, you were feeling overwhelmed.
Well, yes, I was.
Do you remember what thoughts were connected to?
Another part of what we can do, when the person has extreme contradictory ideas and is not processing, she's feeling overwhelmed and incapable, and she's feeling she should handle everything on her own. If I point those two out, then they sort of meet, and that's going to start her processing, wait a minute, I feel like I should handle it myself. I feel like I'm totally incapable. What's going on here? Now, also, we may want to spend some session time on that, too. But simply pointing out the contributions can be real useful.
So she's, I think, at least twice is saying, like, I don't even know why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't really take the bait or anything, it seems like.
Well, part of what I'm doing is choosing my targets. You know, and that's really important when so much is going on. If it seemed to me she was having serious doubts about being here, then I need to get that on the table and address it so that she will be back next week. If I just ignore it, then it's not being addressed and she might drop out. My sense is that, you know, that's something she's mentioning in passing, but does not seem that, you know, what seems to be more important to get to is her being angry at me. And, her... you know, high standards for herself and so on. And it's important to not take every piece of bait, but choose which ones to take on. Yeah?
What is her goal for the therapy?
Her goal is to get in gear on job hunting and find a job, deal with her depression, deal with her panic attacks, deal with her relationship issues. At this point, the top two are her depression and her inability to get in gear on job hunting. Hmm. And the others are down the road.
But she has a job coach, doesn't she? Did she
mention that? Yeah.
Okay. So, with you, she's doing the same thing?
Well, no, I'm not doing job coaching.
Oh, you are doing
But I'm working with her on her procrastination, which is something that her job coach does not deal with.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I suppose I was feeling overwhelmed because maybe 50 letters was too much to decide to do all at once. I don't know.
So you're not sure if you think maybe it had something to do with 50 letters being too much.
What do you think?
Would it have felt different if you set a different goal, if you said, can you write two letters today? Would that have felt just as overwhelming?
Well, hardly. I mean, two letters is nothing. You know, two letters, I could write two letters a day.
Mm-hmm. So, sounds like you're saying that wouldn't have felt overwhelming, but it wouldn't have felt like much of an accomplishment.
Well, no, it wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to take a step back, because one of the first things you said was that the week was a complete failure. Working on getting yourself more involved in day-to-day activities didn't help at all. The job letter situation was a disaster.
Yeah. Now, as I remember it,
our idea with the increasing your activity level was to see if that would improve your mood, figuring that if you were in a better mood, that would put you in a better position to work on job hunting.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it accomplished that briefly, and then you started feeling like you should be doing important stuff instead of housework and grocery shopping and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah. And then with the job letters, the idea we had at the end of the last session was that what you do is sit down and try to write some job letters, figuring that you'd find it hard to do, but that it'd be an opportunity to notice what it is that gets in the way. And it sounds like that's sort of what happened. He sat down to do it, found it hard to do, didn't get around to doing it, but noticed a whole bunch of different things going on.
And your average nice Axis One client about this point would be saying, gee, you're right, Doc. The week wasn't a disaster. It actually accomplished what we were setting out to accomplish. It's not always that simple with borderline clients.
But that's it. Sound like a complete failure to you?
Well, I don't know, you know, maybe from the angle that you're talking about, it's not a complete failure, but it seems to me that it's a complete failure because I didn't get any of it done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you see it.
So, what do I want to do? Well, I don't just forget about it. You know, we want to accomplish our objective and then move on. But I don't want to just pound my head against a stone wall either. You know, so I want to think, what options do I have? How can I deal with this? What's the sticking point here? And one of the things I notice is she's talking as though her week is either a success or a failure. It sounds like we've got some dichotomous thinking going on. And wait a minute, I'm dealing with borderline personality disorder. I want to watch for good opportunities to address dichotomous thinking early in therapy. And how do I want to do that? I like the continuum technique. So this sounds like a great opportunity to see about doing a continuum.
Have taken for this week to really count as a success, be a real success.
Once it becomes a real success, then I really would have written the 50 letters and gotten them out, because you know then I would have felt like it really accomplished something.
Mm-hmm. Now, is writing 50 letters all it would have taken for the week to count as a real success, or would there be additional things that take to?
Well, I didn't have any other goal for the week. Mm-hmm. That was the only goal that I set for myself for the week.
Yeah. So it sounds like basically real success is when you meet your goal.
Well, yeah.
But you were saying that if your goal had been 2 letters, that wouldn't have felt like much of an accomplishment. If your goal was
not much of a goal.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like real success, you meet your goal, but the goal has to be up to a certain standard.
Well, sure it does. If your goals have to be based on the kind of person you are. And your own achievement level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And are you saying that for you, it's got to be a pretty high goal?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because if it's not a high goal, then it's like it's not worth working for.
Yeah. Okay.
Unfortunately, I write a little slow, so it takes me a minute to write that down.
I have to expect a lot of myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Otherwise, nothing will happen.
Okay, let me get that now. Here, I think we'd be good for us to come back to that. Anything else that happened.
Now, you notice I got it wrong when I, summarized what she'd said. What she said was, the hopes you've pinned to other people fall through. What other people does she have in mind? She's mad at me. But my defenses are kicking in again, and we are human. She's not going to let me off the hook anyway.
Well, what's keeping you from just, like, grabbing her and saying, just write one freaking letter? I wouldn't have the patience.
Well, and patience is real useful.
It also works better. If saying, write one freaking letter, if that would work, then, I would sign up for it.
Also trying out the suggestions that you had and having them not really work. That seems like a failure to me. Okay.
She's kind of inclined to fail, too.
I said
she's kind of inclined
to fail. As you see it, is, are we either a success or a failure? Is this sort of, it's either one or the other type situation?
Well, I probably don't even see it on a weekly basis. I probably see it on a daily basis, whether...
And it sounds like what you said here would apply for a day just as well as for a week, perhaps. Right. A person could do it hour by hour or minute by minute. So.
Are you being condescending? No.
Now, did that say I'm condescending to you guys?
No.
I've listened to this tape many times. A, I was not feeling condescending at the moment. Maybe a little dense. This was not my most fluent and smooth line of intervention. But it also doesn't sound condescending to me. But she experiences it as condescending. How do I want to deal with that? If I just skate by it and ignore it, then she thinks I'm being condescending. That's going to have an impact on how the rest of the session goes. That's going to have an impact on whether she comes back next week. Just ignoring it is not a good move. If I get into defending myself, that's going to stir things up rather than prove it. What I want to do is address it, but it's not our main issue. It's something I need to address in order to, accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish. So I want to just quickly and straightforwardly explain, no, this is what I was doing. And if that makes sense to her, if it sinks in, great, we've cleared it up, we can move on. If it doesn't sink in, then I need to work on it however long it takes to get to the point where she's no longer seeing me as condescending. Let me back up just a hair here.
Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
If she felt like you were condescending, what she said, is it okay to, in that moment, to ask that question like, okay, because I'm always asking this question, your condescending is different from my condescending.
Mm-hmm.
Can you please explain to me what you're hearing and what you're saying? Obviously, I must have missed it.
Yeah, that's a completely legit question to ask. I don't do it in this occasion because I've got other stuff I'm trying to get to, and that takes time, and I think I've got enough of an understanding of what she's
doing.
Condescending.
No, I'm trying to make sure that I'm understanding it in your terms, and I'd like you to let me know if I've got it wrong.
Because, a lot of these terms are things that different people use in different ways. Different people have different ideas of success. And it's hard for me to talk with you about success unless I know what it means to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do I know whether I can move on or not? Well, one of the things I do is pay attention to the nonverbal cues. She nods. She agrees to me. She's still in a... She had shifted into a closed posture. She's still in a closed posture. Mm-hmm. But she's nodding and agreeing with me. I figure this is good enough to move on. It turns out I'm right about that. If she wasn't nodding and agreeing with me, I'd address it in greater depth. If she had shifted back to an open posture, I'd be more confident that it had been resolved enough so that we could move on. You know, and I think part of her closed posture is she can tell I've got something in mind. She doesn't know what I'm building up to. And I think that's part of why she was vigilant and misconstrued me as being condescending. You know, she feels like she's being set up, which is not quite what's happening, but I do have something in mind, which is part of my job, is to have something in mind.
Basically, a total failure would be a chunk of time where you don't do anything that you plan to do. Nothing good happens. Other people don't do anything that's good to you. And to top it all off, you try some things that seem promising and they fall through.
Right.
And a real success would be when you set a high goal and accomplish it.
Right. That would be a real success.
Yeah. And it seems like it's something that's either a success or a failure.
Okay.
Well, let's take this past week rather than breaking it down day by day, because I've got, from talking with you, I've got an image of what the week was, but I don't know what happened on each day.
Yeah.
Okay. One characteristic of it.
Did you notice the eye roll there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who's being condescending? She's reacting. What an idiot. But I don't need to get all huffy about that. A, in just a minute she'll discover I'm not as much of an idiot as she thinks I am. And B, my ego is okay. I don't have to, you know, get into that. But I think part of, you know, her seeing me as condescending is that I suspect this has something to do with how she looks at others. And it's, you know, it's what the analysts would call projective identification. But c'est la vie. You know, it's not being a problem, so I don't need to address it at the moment. Come on, machine.
Is that you don't do anything you plan to do. Would that fit for this week?
Well, I did plan to get out of the rut of not doing anything at all, and I did that. I started to do things around the house that I had felt unable to do before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, so on that criteria, the week wouldn't qualify as a total failure. Does that mean the week was a success?
Well, it doesn't mean a week was a success. It might mean that maybe it wasn't a total failure, maybe.
But not a full-blown success either.
No.
And it certainly wouldn't meet your standards of setting high goals and accomplishing them completely. Because with the getting out of the rut, being more active, it accomplished part of what you wanted. It left you feeling better. You got some stuff around the house done. But it didn't leave you, but then you started feeling guilty. So it was a short
term. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, yeah. How about in terms of not having anything good happen? You haven't mentioned any good things that happened last week. Was it a week where nothing good happened?
Well, I mean, some enjoyable things happened. I mean, my husband and I went out one night, and we had a good time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like it wouldn't count as a total bust on that criterion either.
No.
But one night is something
that doesn't
make it.
I mean, I do enjoy being with them.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten married.
Yeah. And then the other criterion for failure we had down here was trying something that positive and that something that seemed promising and having fall through. And that certainly happened to some extent. Did all the promising things you tried fall through?
Well, I suppose not completely. I mean, now that you...
Because I
don't really think about it in the way you're talking about. Because the ideas you gave me really did, I mean, they did put me in a better mood, even though I guess the point where I felt guilty for not doing what I felt I ought to be doing instead of doing things around the house, but it did at least get me up off the couch.
Yeah, and they had somewhat different results than we expected.
Yeah.
But you remember what I said when we came up with the assignment, that we had set up so that if
you went ahead and did it, and it worked the way we expected. Great, that was progress towards accomplishing what we want to accomplish.
Yeah.
If it didn't, if either you did it and it turned out different than we expected, or if you found you couldn't do it but could notice what got in the way, then we were making discoveries. We were learning new things about what gets in the way, about what's going on with the problems. And that's also progress towards accomplishing what we want to accomplish, because we're going to need to figure this out more.
Yeah, I guess so.
And I don't know if any of this stuff is new to you, but I've certainly learned a lot more about what gets in the way of you being able to do the job.
No, I just feel it is new in a way.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about things like this, you know.
And it sounds like one thing that was happening here is the week clearly wasn't a complete success. And it was seeming as though if something wasn't a success, it was a failure. And so you reacted as though the week was a complete failure. You had to pretty strongly
felt, yeah.
But now that we talk about the specifics, the week isn't really falling in the complete failure camp or the complete success camp. It sounds like there must be something in between the two.
I suppose.
Maybe something along the lines of a partial success or partial
failure. Yeah, qualified success, I suppose.
Yeah. But how about if we think of it this way? Let's think of in terms of a rating scale, from an absolute total failure with no redeeming social value to a complete success with nothing whatsoever wrong with it. An absolute failure is zero.
Yeah.
A complete success is a 10. Where would you put this week?
I don't know. I guess about at least a 3, maybe a 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you could, you'd like to have weeks go better.
Yeah. If I could, I would definitely like to have weeks go better.
Yeah. And I think we're going to be able to come up with some ways of having weeks go better. Now, one thing you said a few minutes ago I wanted to come back to was, I have to expect a lot of myself, otherwise nothing will happen. And that's the way you want to rep out this week. You know, I think that really captures part of how you live your life. You set up, I'm going to write 50 letters.
Yeah, it was a pretty gung-ho goal, don't you think?
But I think it was a pretty gung-ho goal. The idea in this thought is that if you expect a lot of yourself, then something will happen. If you don't expect a lot of yourself, nothing will happen. Now, this week, you expected a lot of yourself. How many of those letters did you get written?
Well, maybe I got the first one written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, she didn't. If she had written a letter, would she say, maybe a hat, I got one written? No. No. Clearly, she got part of one written, and she's lying. Do I call her on it? A, that would get us off into a whole different issue that would take up a bunch of session time. B, she hasn't been lying to me on a regular basis. You know, C, I can accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish with her claiming to have written one letter. And so I'm going to choose not to address it now. I'm going to file it away for future reference. If she lies to me on a regular basis, we're going to need to address that, because that gives, you know, if she succeeds in misleading me, that makes it harder for me to be helpful to her. And if she doesn't succeed in misleading me, it's going to end up being aggravating and get in the way of me being helpful to her. But, you know, I don't need to address it today. You know, I do need to notice if it ends up being an ongoing problem.
You, how would it would have felt to set your goal as writing 2 letters? You said that that would be no big deal. Yeah. What do you think would have happened if you managed to set a goal with 2 letters? Do you think you would have gotten those 2 written?
Well, sure. I probably would have gotten 2 written.
Sure. Yeah. Which would be twice as many as you got written setting your goal with 50. How does that fit with the idea that setting high standards gets things to happen, that setting manageable standards makes
that nothing's going to happen.
Yeah, but that's not just a manageable standard. That's an elementary standard.
Well, okay, so if an elementary standard works better than a high standard, I agree. If you could find a manageable standard that's more than elementary, that might work better than an elementary standard. But it sounds like what you're running into is if we set the standard a couple notches too high, it gets in the way rather than helping.
And one of the many challenges is pacing. You know, part of what I do as I'm doing this is I pay attention to the nonverbal cues and so on. You know, if she's hesitating, thinking, and then nodding and agreeing with me, I know I'm not going too fast. I'm not leaving her behind in the dust. You know, if she's starting to look dazed and not get it, then I need to slow down, take it in smaller steps. And she's a pretty bright, capable person. This pace works for her. There are lots of perfectly fine people where I need to take it a little slower and break it down into smaller steps for it to sink in. And at this point, we then go on to coming up with a new homework assignment, which is essentially a behavioral experiment. You know, we could try to figure out intellectually what sort of goal would have her at peak performance, or we could use trial and error. You know, each day, set a goal for herself in terms of how many letters she's going to get written, give it a try, see how it goes, notice what gets in the way, and then learn from the results. If she sets a goal of 2 letters and gets 2 letters done, hey, we know a goal 2 letters is a good idea. If it feels like she could have done more, try raising it a notch or two and see how that works. If she sets a goal of 5 letters and this is overwhelming, then we know that's too high, take it down a notch or two. And by the end of the week, she'll know how many letters she can get written in a day and what goal for herself results in her getting as many letters as possible written. That made sense to her. She was happy signing on to that. You know, so, you know, we've accomplished a number of different objectives today.
So this kind seems to be more like a milder form of borderline personality disorder. There are some, like, those, you know, crises every day. I was just wondering, in terms of her primary...
No, it's not necessarily that she's all that mild. She's in a major depression. She has a history of panic disorder. She has a history of losing several jobs by virtue of throwing a temper tantrum on the job. Mm. You know, I don't remember if she's cut herself or made suicide attempts or not. It's been a long time since I saw her, so I don't remember. You know, so one of the things is if you can manage the interpersonal complexities, then people don't look nearly as screwy as if you're doing things that set off their issues. And that one of the things I like about this approach to intervention is it results in people doing a lot better both in the office and in day-to-day life in the short run, as well as being effective in the long run. And one of the complexities of dealing with borderline personality disorder is if we interact with them in ways that accidentally set off their fear of abandonment and so on, then things get a lot more intense and screwier. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can manage not to set that off, things don't get so intense. If we can calm that down, things improve. At this point, let's take a 5-minute break. And I'm going to try to zip through stuff so that we have time for consultation.